can't help myself. Instantly, I feel a vision forming and hear the whispers. I feel myself floating up through the darkness, then, as if shot through a cannon, I blaze through a shadowy tunnel. Black turns to blue, blue turns to green. The whispers follow me, growing weaker the farther down the tunnel I go. Suddenly, I'm jolted to a stop and everything falls silent. A gust of wind appears with a bright light, and when I look down, I realize I'm standing on the snowy peak of a mountain. The view is spectacular, with mountains stretching for miles. There's a deep green valley below me and a crystal blue lake. I'm drawn to the lake and begin descending when I see tiny bursts of light surrounding it. As if I'm wearing binoculars, my vision is suddenly magnified, and I see hundreds of heavily armed Mogadorians shooting at four running figures. My anger is immediate, and colors blur as I run down the mountain. A few hundred yards from the lake, the sky growls above me with a black wall of clouds. Bolts of lightning crash into the valley, and thunder roars. I'm knocked off my feet as lightning strikes all around me, and that's when I see the glowing eye form and stare down from the clouds. "Six!" I yell, but the thunder drowns me out. I know it's her, but what is she doing here? The clouds part, and someone drops into the valley. My vision magnifies again, and I see that I was right. Six stands furious between the advancing army of Moogs and two young girls and two older men. Her arms are above her head, and a steady sheet of rain falls. "Six!" I yell again, and a pair of hands grabs my shoulders from behind. My eyes snap open, and I whip my head off the table. The lights in the interrogation room are on, and there's a tall man with a round face standing above me. He's wearing a dark suit with a badge clipped to his belt. In his hands is the white tablet.
"Chill out, kid. I'm Detective Will Murphy, FBI. How we doing today?"
"Never better," I reply, dazed by the vision. "Who was Six protecting?"
"Good," he says.
The detective sits, a pen and legal pad in front of him. He carefully displays the tablet on the left side of the table.
"So," he begins, slowly drawing it out. "Six what? What do you have Six of?"
"What?"
"You were yelling the number Six in your sleep. You want to tell me what that's all about?"
"It's my golf handicap," I say. My mind tries to conjure up the faces of the two girls behind Six in the valley, but they're fuzzy. Detective Murphy chuckles.
"Yeah, right. How about you and me have a little chat? Let's start with the birth certificate you gave to Paradise High. It's counterfeit, John Smith. In fact, we can't find a single thing about you prior to you showing up in Paradise several months ago," he says, squinting as though expecting some reply. "Your social security number belongs to a dead man in Florida."
"Was there a question there?"
His grin turns into a smirk. "Why don't you start by telling me your real name?"
"John Smith."
"Right," he says. "Where's your father, John?"
"Dead."
"How convenient."
"Actually, it's probably the most inconvenient thing that's ever happened to me up until now."
The detective writes something on the notepad. "Where are you originally from?"
"The planet Lorien, 300 million miles away."
"Must have been a long trip, John Smith."
"Took almost a year. Next time, I'm bringing a book."
He drops his pencil on the table, interlocks his fingers behind his head, and leans back.
Then he pushes forward again and holds up the tablet.
"You want to tell me what this thing is?"
"I was hoping you could tell me. We found it in the woods."
He holds it by its edge and whistles. "You found this in the woods? Where out in the woods?"
"Near a tree."
Are you going to be a wise ass with every question?
That depends, Detective. Are you working for them?
He sets the tablet back on the desktop. Am I working for who?
The Morlocks, I say, the first thing I remember from English class.
Detective Murphy smiles.
You can smile, but they'll probably be here soon, I say.
The Morlocks.
Yes, sir.
Like from the time machine.
That's the one. That's like our Bible.
And let me guess, you and your friend, Samuel Good, you're members of the Eloi.
The Lorik, actually. But for our purposes today, the Eloi will be fine.
The detective reaches into his pocket and slams my dagger on the table. I stare at its 4-inch diamond blade as if I've never seen it before. I could easily kill this man just by moving my eyes from the blade to his neck, but I need to free Sam first.
What's this for, John? Why would you need a knife like this?
I don't know what knives like that are for, sir. Whittling?
He picks up his notepad and pencil.
Why don't you tell me what happened in Tennessee?
Never been, I say. I hear it's a nice place, though. Maybe I'll visit when I'm out of here, take a tour, see the sights. Any suggestions?
He nods, tosses the notepad onto the table, and then launches the pencil at me. I deflect it without lifting a finger, sending it bouncing against the wall. But the detective doesn't notice, and leaves through the steel door with the tablet and my dagger.
Soon I'm shoved back into my old cell.
I have to get out of here.
Sam! I yell. The guard who's been sitting outside my cell jumps off his chair and swings the nightstick at my fingers. I let go of the bars just before they're crushed.
Shut up,
he orders, pointing his nightstick at me.
You think I'm afraid of you? I ask. Getting him inside my cell sounds like a pretty good option.
I could give a damn, Pee-wee, but if you keep it up, you're gonna regret it real fast.
You couldn't hit me if you tried. I'm too quick, and you're too fat. The guard chuckles.
Why don't you just sit back on your bed and shut your mouth, huh?
You know I can kill you any time I want to, right? Without even lifting a finger?
Oh, yeah?
He replies. The guard steps forward. His breath smells rancid, like stale coffee.
What's stopping you, then?
Apathy and a broken heart, I say. Both of those will go away eventually, though, and that's when I'll just get up and leave.
I can hardly wait, Houdini,
he says. I'm extremely close to taunting him inside, and as soon as he unlocks the door, Sam and I are as good as free.
You know who you look like? I ask.
Tell me,
he says. I turn around and bend over.
That's it, punk!
The guard reaches for a control panel on the wall, and as he's stomping towards the door of my cell, an ear-splitting blast rattles the entire jail. The guard stumbles into the bars and smacks his forehead, falling to his knees. I drop and instinctively roll beneath the bed. Pandemonium erupts. Yells and gunshots, clanking metal and loud bangs. An alarm goes off, and a blue light flashes in the corridor. I roll onto my back and twist my hands to get a firm grip on the chain binding my wrists. While using my legs as leverage, I straighten myself and snap the chain binding my hands and feet in two. I use telekinesis to unlock my cuffs and drop them to the floor. I do the same with a pair around my ankles.
John! Sam yells from down the hall.
I crawl to the front of the cell.
Right here!
What's going on?
I was going to ask you the same thing, I yell back.
Other prisoners shout through their cell bars, too. The guard who fell in front of my cell grunts and struggles to his feet. Blood flows from a gash on his head. The ground shakes again. It's more violent and lasts longer than the first time, and a fog of dust barrels down the corridor from the right. I'm temporarily blinded, but reach my hand through the bars and yell to the guard,
"Let me out of here!"
Hey, how do you get your cuffs off?
I see he's disoriented, wavering a few steps to his right, a few to his left, ignoring the other guards who run by him with guns drawn. He's covered in dust. 1,000 gunshots come from the right end of the corridor. A roar of a beast answers them.
John!
Sam screams in a pitch I've never heard from him before. I make eye contact with the guard and yell, "We're all going to die in here if you don't let me out!" The guard looks towards the roars, and terror spreads across his face. He slowly reaches for his gun, but before he can touch the grip, it floats away from him. I know that trick. I saw that in Florida on a midnight walk, and I watch as the guard spins in confusion and runs. 6 becomes visible in front of my door, the large pendant still around her neck, and from the second I see her face, I know she's pissed at me. I also see that she's in a very big hurry to get me out of here.
"What's down there, 6? Is Sam okay? I can't see anything," I say.
She looks down the corridor and concentrates on something, and a set of keys comes floating down the corridor, right into her hands. She inserts them into a metal panel on the wall. My door unlocks. I run out of my cell, and I'm finally able to see down the corridor. It's extremely long, with at least 40 cells between me and the exit. But the exit is gone, as is the wall it should be on, and I'm staring at the giant horned head of a piken. 2 guards are in its mouth, and drool mixed with blood falls from its razor-sharp teeth.
"Sam!"
I yell, but he doesn't answer. I turn to 6.
"Sam's down there!"
She disappears before my eyes, and 5 seconds later, I watch another cell slide open. Sam rushes towards me. I yell,
"Okay, 6, let's trash this thing!"
Inches from my nose, 6's face appears.
"We're not fighting the piken, not here."
"Are you kidding me?" I ask.
"There's more important stuff we have to do, John,"
she barks.
"We have to get to Spain immediately."
"Now?"
"Now!"
6 grabs my hand and pulls me after her until I'm running at a full clip. Sam is right behind me, and we're able to get through 2 sets of doors with 6's keys. As the second one is flung open, we're faced with 7 Moogs running with cylindrical cannon-like tubes and swords. Instinctively, I reach for my dagger, but it's not there. 6 throws me the guard's gun, then holds me and Sam back. She lowers her head in concentration. The lead Moog is spun around, and his sword slices across the 2 behind him, turning them to ash. 6 then kicks the Moog in the back, and he falls on his own sword. She's invisible before he dies. Sam and I duck the first tube's blast, and the second one singes the collar of my shirt. I shoot, emptying my pistol as I slide into the piles of ash. I kill 1 Moog, and then pick up his dropped tube. Hundreds of lights spark to life the second my finger finds the trigger, and a green beam cuts through another Moog. I aim for the last 2, but 6 has already appeared behind them, lifting both to the ceiling with telekinesis. She slams them against the ground in front of me, then back to the ceiling, and then again on the ground. My jeans are covered in their ash. 6 unlocks another door, and we enter a large room with dozens of cubicles on fire. Holes smolder in the ceiling. Moogs are shooting at police, and police are firing back. 6 wrestles a sword away from the nearest Moog and cuts off his arm, and then she jumps over a burning cubicle wall. I blast the stumbling one-armed Moog in the back with my tube, and he falls into a black heap of ash. I see an unconscious Detective Murphy on the ground. 6 darts through the maze of cubicles, swinging her sword so fast it blurs. Moogs turn to ash all around her. Police retreat through a door on the far left as 6 slices through a circle of Moogs closing in on her. I shoot and shoot, destroying those on the perimeter. When the room is clear, we run down an empty hallway under a shower of sparks.
"There!"
Sam points to a giant hole leading out into a parking lot. We don't hesitate, each one of us jumping through sparks and smoke, and before I sprint into the cold morning, I see my dagger and the tablet sitting on the desk in the office. I reach over and scoop them both up, and seconds later I'm following Six and Sam into a deep ditch that provides us plenty of cover.
"We're not going to talk about that right now," Six says, her arms pumping fast.
She dropped the sword a mile back. I tossed the Moog tube under a bush.
"But do you have it, though?"
"John, not right now."
"But do you?"
Six comes to an abrupt halt.
"John, you want to know where your chest is?"
"In the trunk of the car?"
I ask, my eyebrows raised in apology.
"Nope,"
she says.
"Try again."
"Hidden in a dumpster?"
Six lifts her arms above her head, and a gust of wind sends me flying until I hit a massive oak tree. She marches towards me, fists at her sides.
"How is she?"
"Who?" I ask.
"Your girlfriend, you asshole! Was it worth it? Was it worth leaving me surrounded by Moogs fighting to get your chest back to see precious little Sarah? Was it worth getting arrested for? Did you get enough kisses to make up for getting your face slapped all over the news again?"
"No," I mumble. "I think Sarah turned us in."
"I think so, too," Sam says.
"And you!"
Six spins around to raise her finger at Sam.
"You went along with it? I thought you were smarter than that, Sam. You're supposed to be some kind of genius, and you think it's a good idea to go to the one place in the whole world that the police would definitely be watching?"
"I've never called myself a genius,"
Sam says, picking up the tablet I dropped, brushing dirt from it. Six keeps walking.
"And Six, I had no choice. Seriously, I tried as hard as I could to get John to go back and look for you and help."
"He did," I mutter, standing. "Don't blame Sam."
"Well, John, while you two lovebirds were hugging and kissing, I was getting my ass kicked, doing you a favor. I would have died if Bernie Kosar didn't grow into this giant elephant bear animal and help. They have your chest, and I'm sure by this point it's sitting right next to mine in the cave in West Virginia."
"Then that's where I'm going," I say.
"No, we're going to Spain today."
"No, we're not," I shout, brushing off my sleeves. "Not until I have my chest back."
"Well, I'm going to Spain," she says.
"Why now?" Sam asks.
Our SUV comes into view.
"I was just online. It's serious over there. Somebody burned a huge symbol into the mountainside over Santa Teresa, and it looks exactly like the brands around our ankles. Someone needs our help, and I'm going."
We hop in the car, and Six drives slowly down the road, and Sam and I hide in the footwells of the back seat. Bernie Kosar barks from the passenger seat, happy to be riding shotgun for a change. Sam and I pass the laptop back and forth, both of us reading the article about Santa Teresa twice, three times. The burning symbol on the mountain is no doubt Lorik.
"What if it's a trap?" I ask.
"My chest is more important right now. It might be selfish, but before I leave the continent, I want my inheritance. The possibility that the Moogs might open my chest is just as urgent to me as whatever is going on in Spain."
"I need to know how to get to the cave," I say.
"John, get real. You're really not going to come with me to Spain?"
Six asks.
"After reading all that, you're going to let me and Sam go alone?"
"Guys, get this. Also out of Santa Teresa, there's a woman reported to have been cured out of the blue of an incurable degenerative disease. Santa Teresa is like an epicenter of activity right now. I bet every member of the guard are on their way," Sam says.
"If that's the case," I say, "then I'm definitely not going. I'm getting my chest back."
"That's insane," Six says.
I scramble over the passenger seat and open the glove compartment. My fingers find the stone I'm looking for,
and I drop it in Six's lap before hiding in the footwell again. She lifts the pale yellow stone above the wheel, turning it over in the sunlight and laughs.
You have the Zitharis out.
I figured it might come in handy, I say.
These don't last long, remember, she says.
How long?
An hour, maybe a little more.
The news is discouraging, but it could still give me the advantage I need.
Can you charge it, please?
When Six holds the Zitharis to her temple, I know she's agreed to let me go after the chests while she heads to Spain.
Chapter 26. I do it without even thinking. The second the man points at me from the edge of the hole in the roof, I send two metal bed frames rocketing towards him. The second one is a direct hit. He falls forward and into the sleeping quarters, and when he hits the stone floor, to my amazement, he turns into a pile of dirt or ash. Run! Adelina screams. We crash into the hallway, pushing against the flow of the other girls and sisters heading to the south wing for safety. I take hold of Adelina's hand and guide us to the nave and down the center aisle. Where are we going? Adelina yells. We're not leaving without the chest! Another explosion rocks the foundation of the orphanage, and my hip crashes into a pew. I'll be right back, I whisper, releasing her hand, floating towards the nook.
Six tells us we're close to Washington, D.C., and that makes sense. I am considered an armed and dangerous terrorist. No wonder I was taken to the nation's capital for questioning.
There's a flight leaving Dulles International in less than an hour, she says, turning the wheel. I'm getting on that plane. Sam, are you with me, or are you with John?
Sam places his forehead on the back seat and closes his eyes.
Sam?
Six asks.
I'm thinking, he says.
After a minute, he raises his head and looks right at me.
I'm going with John.
I mouth, thank you.
It'll be easier for me to get there alone anyway,
Six says, but she sounds hurt.
You'll be fighting with more experienced guard members, I reassure her. Plus, it's probably going to take two of us to get both of our chests out of there.
Bernie Kosar barks from the front seat.
Yeah, buddy, I say. You're a part of this team, too.
The chest is gone. My entire body sweats with panic. I almost vomit. Do the Mogadorians know it was up here the whole time? Why didn't they trap me in here when they had the chance? I float back onto the nave floor. It's gone, Adelina, I whisper. The chest? It's gone. I hug her and bury my face in her shoulder. She pulls something up over her head. It's a pale blue, almost transparent amulet attached to a beige cord. She carefully slips it over my hair until the amulet touches my neck. It's both cold and warm at the same time against my skin, and then it glows brightly. My breath is taken away. What is it? I ask, covering the glow with my hands. Lorelite, the most powerful gem on Lorien, found only at its core, she whispers. I've hidden it this whole time. It's yours, and there's no use in hiding it any longer. They know who you are, with or without the amulet. I'll never forgive myself for not training you properly. Never. I'm sorry, Marina. It's okay, I say, feeling tears well up behind my eyes. All these years, this was all I had wanted from her. Understanding, companionship, the acknowledgement of shared secrets.
We get closer to the airport, and the fear of splitting up weighs heavily on us. Sam tries to distract himself by studying the papers Six took from his dad's office.
I wish I could spread these out in some library's reference section.
After West Virginia, I say. I promise. Six gives me and Sam careful instructions on how to find the map that'll take us to the cave. The rest of the trip passes in silence. We pull into a McDonald's parking lot a mile from Dulles.
There are three things you guys have to know.
I sigh. Why do I have the feeling that none of these things are going to be good? She ignores me and writes something on the back of a receipt.
First, here's the address that I'll be at in exactly 2 weeks at 5 p.m. Meet me there. If I'm not there, or if for some reason you aren't, then return in another week and I'll do the same. If one of us doesn't make it after the second week, then I think we can assume the other isn't coming.
She hands it to Sam, who reads it and shoves it into his jeans pocket. 2 weeks, 5 p.m., I say. Got it. The second thing?
Bernie Kosar can't go into the cave with you.
Why not?
Because it'll kill him. I don't understand it completely, but the Mogadorians control their beasts by filtering some sort of gas throughout the cave that only affects animals. If one leaves its designated place, it drops dead. When I finally got out, there was a heap of dead animals right at the cave's entrance. Animals that had gotten too close.
Gross, Sam says. And the last thing?
Their cave is equipped with every detection device you can think of. Cameras, motion detectors, body temperature gauges, infrared, everything. The Zatharis will allow you to get past everything, but once it's out of juice, look out, because they're going to find you.
Where do we go? I ask Adelina. Now that the chest is gone, I feel directionless, even with the amulet around my neck. We go to the belfry, and you use your telekinesis to get us into the yard. Then we run. I take her hand and start running when a ball of fire suddenly roars from the back of the nave. The fire takes hold of the back pews and rages towards the high ceiling. The nave is now brighter than it is during Sunday Mass. A man in a trench coat with long blonde hair walks confidently out of the northern hallway, our path to freedom, and every muscle in my body seems to come unwound at the same time. Every inch of skin breaks out with goosebumps. He stands watching us, the flames attacking several more rows of pews, and then a sneer slowly breaks across his face. From the corner of my eye, I can see Adelina reach into her dress and remove something, but I can't tell what it is. She stands beside me, her eyes aimed at the back of the nave. And then, ever so gently, she reaches up and pushes me behind her. I can't make up for lost time or for the wrongs that I've done, she says. But I'm certainly going to try. Don't let them catch you. Just then, the Mogadorian comes charging towards us, right down the center aisle. He's far larger than he looked from a distance, and he lifts a long sword that glows a fluorescent green color. Get as far from here as you can, Adelina says without turning. Be brave, Marina.
Six places the Zatharis into the console's cup holder, and then slides out of the SUV.
I'm running late,
she says as she closes her door. Sam and I both exit the vehicle after carefully studying the parking lot, the other cars, the people milling about. I round the front of the hood and watch as Six hugs Sam.
Kick some ass over there, he says.
They separate, and she says,
Sam, thank you for helping us, even when you don't have to. Thank you for being so amazing.
You're amazing, he whispers. Thanks for letting me tag along.
To my surprise and Sam's, Six steps forward and kisses him on the cheek. They smile at each other, and once Sam sees me over Six's shoulder, he blushes, opens the driver's door, and climbs inside. I don't want her to go. As much as it pains me to admit it, I know I might never see her again. She looks at me with a certain tenderness that I'm not sure I've ever seen from her before.
I like you, John. For the past few weeks, I've tried convincing myself that I don't, especially because of Sarah and how much of an idiot you can be. But I do. I do like you.
The words knock me over. I hesitate, then say, I like you too.
Do you still love Sarah? She asks.
I nod. She deserves the truth. I do, but it's all really confusing. She may have turned me in, and she may never want to see me again because I told her I thought you were pretty. But Henri once said that the Lorik fall in love once in their life, and so that means I will always love Sarah. Six shakes her head.
Don't take offense at what I'm about to say, okay? But Katerina never told me that. In fact, she told me stories about multiple loves she had on Lorien over the years. I'm sure Henri was a great man, and there's no doubt that he loved you with everything he had. But it sounds like he was a romantic and wanted you to follow in his footsteps. If he had one true love, then he wanted you to have one too.
I'm silent, taking in her theory and pushing Henri's to the side. She can tell I'm struggling with her words.
What I'm saying is, when the Lorik fall in love, a lot of times it is for life. Obviously it was for Henri, but not always.
And with that last sentence, Six steps towards me, and I step towards her. The kiss that eluded us at the end of our walk in Florida now connects us with a passion I thought I'd reserve for Sarah and Sarah alone. I'd never want this kiss to end, but Sam turns on the engine and we separate. Sam likes you too, you know, I say.
And I like Sam.
I cock my head.
But you just said you like me.
She pushes me on my shoulder.
You like me and Sarah. I like you and Sam. Deal with it.
She turns invisible, but I can sense she's still in front of me.
Please be careful over there, Six. I wish we could all stay together.
Her voice comes out of the air.
Me too, John. But whoever is in Spain needs help. Can't you feel it?
I can tell she's already gone by the time I say yes.
I try to move, but I'm rooted in place. A glint of light in Adelina's hand catches my gaze, and I realize that what she removed from her dress was a kitchen knife. She runs towards the Mogadorian, and I start running down a pew the other way. With precision I've never seen before from her, she drops to the ground as the Mogadorian leaps and swings his sword for her throat. He misses her entirely, and as she comes back up, she catches him flush with the knife's blade across his right thigh. Dark blood spurts out, but it does little to slow the Mogadorian. He turns and brings the sword back down. Adelina rolls forward, and it's with nothing short of awe that I watch her pass the knife across the Mogadorian's other leg as the momentum pushes her to her feet. How can I leave Adelina to fight alone? I stop running, clench my hands into fists, but before I can do anything, the man's left hand is wrapped around Adelina's throat, lifting her off the ground. His right hand drives a sword through her heart.
No!
I yell, jumping on top of the pew's bench, rushing down the wood towards them. Adelina's eyes shut, and with her very last breath, she thrusts her arm up, and the knife's blade cuts an arc in the air in front of her. It falls from her hand and clatters to the floor. For a second, I think she's missed, but I'm wrong. The cut was made so cleanly that a full 2 seconds pass before the dark blood spills out. He drops Adelina and falls to his knees, both hands clutched to the front of his throat to stop the bleeding, but the blood simply cascades through his fingers. I walk towards him and take a deep breath. I raise my hand and lift Adelina's knife from off the floor. I let it hover for a brief moment, and just as his eyes widen at the sight of it, I plunge it into his chest. He disintegrates before my eyes, his body turning to ash and spreading across the floor. I drop to my knees and take Adelina's lifeless body into my arms, cupping the back of her head and pulling her to me. Our cheeks touch, and I begin to cry. She's gone, and regardless of my recently discovered legacy, I know there isn't anything I can do to bring her back. I need help.
Chapter 27.
A growl comes from my left, and I lift my head to see another man in a trench coat with long brown hair. I rush to my feet as the Mogadorian lifts his hand. A flash of light comes from it and hits me hard in the left shoulder, sending me flying backwards. The pain is instant and blinding. It runs down my arm, white hot as though electricity has hit the bone and travels through it. My left hand feels dead, and with my right, I reach up and touch the new gash on my shoulder. I lift my head and look up hopelessly at the Mogadorian. The charm, I think. Adelina told me when we traveled that I couldn't be killed unless it was in the order set by the elders. This wound could be bad enough to kill me. I look down at my ankle to see if there are 6 scars instead of the 3 I've been living with for the last several months, but nothing has changed. Then how can I be killed? How can I be hurt this badly, unless the charm has been broken? My eyes meet the Mogadorian's, and he bursts into a heap of ash. For a crazy moment, I think the intensity of my own thoughts is what killed him, but then I see that standing just behind him is the Mogadorian from the cafe, the one with the book, the one I've been running from. I don't understand. Does their selfishness run so deep that they'll kill one another to be the one who kills me?
Marina, he says.
I can kill you, I say in a shaky voice full of sorrow. The blood continues flowing from my shoulder and runs down my arm. I look over at Adelina's body and start to cry.
I'm not who you think I am, he says, jogging over to me and reaching out his hand. Time is extremely short, he says. I'm one of you, and I'm here to help.
I take his hand. What other choice do I have? He pulls me up and from the nave before any others arrive. He leads me down the northern hallway and to the 2nd floor, heading towards the Belfry Tower. My shoulder screams in pain with each step. Who are you? I ask. 100 different questions race through my head. If he's one of us, then why did it take him so long to tell me? Why torture me into believing he was one of them? Can I even trust him?
Shh, he whispers. Keep quiet. The musty hallway is silent, and as it narrows, I hear dozens of heavy footsteps on the floor below us. Finally, we reach the oak door. It opens just a crack, and a girl's head sticks out. I gasp. Auburn hair, curious brown eyes, small features. She's older by years, but there's no mistaking that it's her.
Ella? I ask.
She looks 11 years old, maybe 12. Her face, which brightens at the sight of mine, is more slender now. Ella pulls the door open so we can enter.
Hi, Marina, she says in a voice I don't recognize.
The man pulls me in, shutting the door. He wedges a thick wooden board between the door and the bottom stair, and the 3 of us rush up the circular stone steps. When we get to the belfry, I take another look at Ella. All I can do is stare at her, wide-eyed and confused, no longer feeling the blood rolling down my arm, dripping from my fingertips.
Marina, my name is Creighton, the man says. I'm sorry about your sapon. I wish I'd gotten there sooner.
Adelina's dead? The older version of Ella asks. I don't understand, I say, still staring at Ella.
We'll explain it all to you, I promise. There isn't much time. You're losing a lot of blood, Creighton says. You can heal people, correct? Can you heal yourself?
With all the confusion and running,
I hadn't considered healing myself, but when I place the palm of my right hand over the gaping wound, I try it. The iciness tickles as the gash closes itself, and the dead numbness is pushed from my hand and arm. After 30 seconds, I'm as good as new.
"Please, be more careful with this," Creighton says. "It's far more vital than you know."
I look to where he's pointing. My chest! There's an explosion nearby. The tower sways and dust and rocks drop from the ceiling and walls. More rocks fall as another blast takes me off my feet. I use my telekinesis to stop their descent, and I fling them out the window.
They're searching for us, and it's not going to take long until they realize where we are, he says.
He looks at Ella, and then at me.
She's one of you, a member of the guard from Lorien.
But she's not old enough, I say,
shaking my head, unable to replace the younger version I've come to know with this older one.
I don't get it.
Do you know what an Eternus is?
I shake my head.
Show her, Ella.
While standing in front of me, Ella begins to change. Her arms shorten and her shoulders narrow. She loses 20 centimeters of height, and her weight drops significantly. The shrinking of her face shocks me the most, and quickly she looks like the tiny girl I've come to love.
She's an Eternus, Creighton says. She's able to move back and forth between different ages.
I didn't know that was possible, I stutter.
Ella's 11 years old, he says. She came with me on a second ship from Lorien that left after yours. She was just a baby, only hours old. Loridos, the last remaining elder, sacrificed himself so that Ella could assume his role and grow into his powers.
As I'm looking at Creighton, Ella slips her hand into mine, as she's done so many times before. But it feels different now. I glance over and see that she's returned to the older, taller version of herself. Recognizing my discomfort, Ella shrinks back down, the 4 years quickly melting away until she's 7 again.
She's the 10th child, he says, the 10th elder. We created a rumor about her backstory, her parents dying in a car accident, and we sent her here to live with you, to watch over you, and to be the eyes I needed.
I'm sorry I couldn't tell you the truth, Marina, she says in her soft voice. But I'm the best secret keeper in the whole world, just like you said.
I know you are, I say.
I was just waiting for Adelina to give you your chest, she says, smiling.
Do you know who the 10th elder was? Creighton asks. Changing his age is how Loridos was able to live as long as he did, even after the other elders had passed away. Each time he grew old, he made himself young again and assumed the vitality that comes with it.
Are you Ella's Sapon?
Only in the surrogate sense of the word. Since she was just born, she hadn't been assigned a Sapon yet.
I thought you were a Mogadorian, I say.
I know, but only because you misinterpreted the clues. This morning, when I was talking to Hector, I was trying to show you I was a friend.
But why didn't you just come and get me when you arrived? Why send Ella in?
I tried approaching Adelina first, but she cast me out the second she knew who I was, and we needed you to have your chest. I couldn't pull you away without it, he says. So I sent Ella in, and she started looking for it even before you asked her to. The Mogadorians have known your general location for a good while now, and I've done my best to keep them off your trail. Killing some? Well, killing most. But also planting stories in villages hundreds of miles away about kids doing amazing things, like about a boy who lifted a car above his head and a girl who could walk across a lake. It was working until they discovered you were in Santa Teresa, but even then, they still didn't know which one you were, Then Ella found the chest, and you opened it, and that's when I came here, to talk to you in private. When you opened the chest, it led the Mogadorians right here.
Because I opened the chest?
Yes. Go ahead. Open it up now.
I let go of Ella's hand and grab hold of the lock. I'm sick, thinking that I'm able to open it on my own now that Adelina is dead. I remove the lock and toss the lid open. The small crystal is still glowing a faint blue.
Don't touch that, he says.
The fact that it's glowing means a macrocosm is in orbit somewhere. If you touch it now, it will tell them exactly where you are. I don't know whose macrocosm is operational, but I'm pretty sure the Mogadorians have stolen somebody's, he finishes. I haven't the slightest idea of what he's talking about.
Macrocosm? I ask.
He shakes his head, frustrated.
There isn't time to explain it all, he says. Relock it.
He opens his mouth to say more, but is interrupted by banging on the door at the bottom of the stairs. We can hear muffled bursts of foreign voices.
We have to go, Creighton says, rushing to the back of the room and grabbing a large black suitcase.
He flings it open, revealing 10 different guns, a handful of grenades, several daggers. He shrugs his coat to the floor and reveals a leather vest, and he rushes to strap every piece of weaponry to it before slipping his coat back on. The Mogadorians ram the door below with a heavy object, and we hear footsteps enter the stairwell. Creighton removes one of the guns and snaps a clip into it.
The burning symbol on the mountain, I say. Was it you?
He nods.
I waited too long, I'm afraid, and when you opened the chest, it became impossible to slip away under their gaze. So I created the biggest beacon I could, and now we have to hope the others have seen it, and that they're on their way. Otherwise, he trails off. Well, otherwise, we're out of options. We have to get to the lake now. It's our only chance. I have no idea what lake he's talking about or why he wants to go there, but my whole body is trembling. I just want to get away. The footsteps are closer. Ella grabs hold of my hand, back to her 11-year-old self. Creighton pulls the slide on the gun, and I hear a bullet clicking into place. He aims it at the belfry's entryway.
You have a very good friend in town, he says.
Hector? I ask, suddenly understanding why the two of them were talking in the cafe this morning. Creighton wasn't spreading lies, but rather telling the truth.
Yes, and let's hope he keeps his word.
Hector will, I say, certain that's true regardless of what Creighton has asked him to do. It's in his name, I add.
Grab the chest, Creighton says.
I reach down and take the chest in my left arm just as we hear the footsteps reach the last curves of the stairwell.
Both of you, stay close to me, Creighton says,
his eyes moving from Ella to me.
She was born able to change ages, but she's young and hasn't developed any legacies yet. Keep her close, and don't let go of that chest.
Don't worry, Marina. I'm fast, she says, smiling.
You two ready?
Ready,
Ella says, tightening her hand around mine.
They're all going to be wearing body armor that would stop almost every bullet here on Earth, Creighton says. But I've soaked mine in Loricide, and there isn't a shield here that could stop them. I'm going to mow every damn one of them down.
His eyes narrow.
Keep your fingers crossed that Hector's outside the gates, waiting for us.
He'll be there, I say. Then Creighton pulls the trigger, and he doesn't let go until every bullet's been fired.
Chapter 28. We keep the windows down, saying little, unnerved by the task ahead.
Sam keeps a firm grip on the wheel as the highway winds through Virginia.
You think Six will make it? Sam asks.
I'm sure she'll make it, but who knows what she'll find.
That was a hell of a kiss you two had.
I open my mouth and then shut it. A minute later, I say, she likes you too, you know.
Yeah, as a friend.
Actually, Sam, she likes you. Sam blushes.
Sure, I could tell by the way she shoved her tongue in your mouth.
She kissed you too, dude. I saw it.
I slap him in the chest with the back of my hand, and I can see he's replaying the kiss in his mind. After I kissed her, I asked if she knew you liked her, and we're jerked over the double yellow line on the road.
You did what?
Dude, relax. Don't kill us. Sam glides us back onto our side of the road. She said she liked you, too. A devilish grin spreads across Sam's face.
Interesting. It's kind of hard to believe this, Sam finally says.
God, Sam, why would I lie about it?
No, I can't believe that this whole thing is real. That you're real, or that Six is real, or that a hostile race of aliens has scattered themselves across the planet, and nobody seems to know it. I mean, they've hollowed out a mountain in the middle of the state. How has it not been found? What did they do with all the dirt and rocks they removed? Even as scarcely populated as parts of West Virginia are, surely somebody had to stumble across it at some point. Hikers or hunters, pilots of small planes, what about satellite imaging? And who knows how many other base camps or outposts or whatever you want to call them they have on Earth. I just don't understand how they move about so freely.
I agree, I say. I don't know how either, but something tells me we probably don't know the half of it. You remember the very first conspiracy theory you told me?
No, Sam says.
We were talking about an entire Montana town being abducted, and you said the government allowed abductions in exchange for technology. Remember now?
Vaguely. Sure.
Well, that makes sense now. Maybe technology has nothing to do with it, and maybe the government isn't allowing abductions, but I really think some agreement has to be in place, because you're right, there's no way they're traveling unnoticed. There are way, way, way too many of them.
Sam doesn't respond. I look over and see that he's smiling. Sam? I ask.
I was just thinking of where I might be at this exact moment if you guys hadn't come along. Probably alone in my basement, collecting more conspiracy theories, and wondering if my dad's still alive. That's how it was for years. But what's awesome is that I really do believe he's alive now. He's somewhere, John, I know it. And I know it because of you guys.
I hope so, I say. It's pretty cool that Henri came to Ohio to try to find him, and you and I became friends almost immediately. It's like fate.
Sam smiles.
Or a cosmic aligning.
Nerd, I say.
After a pause, Sam asks,
Hey, John, you're positive that skeleton in the well wasn't my dad, right?
Absolutely, dude. He was Lorik and huge, bigger than any human.
What's your best guess, then? Who was it?
I really don't know. I just hope he wasn't too important.
4 hours pass, and finally, we see a sign pointing the way to Anstead, 6 miles ahead. We fall silent. Sam makes the turn and navigates a precarious 2-lane road that twists up the mountain until we pass the town's border. We drive through it and turn left at the only stoplight in town.
Hawk's Nest, right?
Yep, 1 or 2 down the road, Sam says.
And it's there we'll find the map that Six drew 3 years ago. The map is exactly where Six said it would be, hidden at Hawk's Nest State Park, overlooking the New River. Exactly 47 steps down the Gisp Trail, Sam, Bernie Kosar, and I reach a tree with E6 deeply carved into its side. From there, we leave the trail, taking 30 steps past the tree to the right. That's followed by a hard left turn, and then, a tenth of a mile away, we see a tree that towers over the others. In the small gap at the base of its twisted trunk, safely tucked away in a black plastic box, is the map that leads to the cave. We make our way back to the SUV and drive another 15 miles, ultimately pulling down a muddy, deserted road. It's the closest any road can get us, 5 miles due north of the cave. Sam takes the address Six wrote out of his pocket and puts it in the glove compartment. On second thought, he removes it and puts it back into his pocket. As safe as anywhere, he says. I drop the Zatharas and some duct tape into Six's backpack that she left behind, and Sam slips the bag over his shoulders. I flip my dagger over in my hand, and then stuff it into my back pocket. We step out, and I lock the doors, Bernie Kosar running circles around my legs. There's only a few hours left of daylight, which doesn't leave us much time. Even with the benefit of my hands, I can't imagine finding the cave without the sun to help us along. Sam holds the map in his hands. At its right side, Six has drawn a heavy X. A winding path 5 miles long connects the X with where we are now, marked on the map's left side. Along the way, we'll skirt a riverbed while passing various landmarks noted for the physical descriptions, all of which are carefully marked to keep us on track. Turtle Rock, Fisherman's Pole, Circle Plateau, King's Throne, Lover's Kiss, Lookout Point. Sam and I lift our heads at the same time, and we both see the rock a quarter mile away with an uncanny resemblance to a turtle shell. Bernie Kosar barks. I guess we know which direction to head first, Sam says. And off we go, following the path set by the map. There's no trail, nothing that might allude to these mountains having been trampled by beings of another world, or even by beings of this one. Once we reach Turtle Rock, Sam spots a fallen tree that hangs over the cliffside at a 45-degree angle, and thus looks like a fishing pole, patiently waiting for a bite, and we hike on, following the trail as the sun lowers in the western sky. Each step taken is another chance to turn around and walk away, but neither of us does. You're a hell of a friend, Sam Good, I tell him. You're not so bad yourself, he replies, and then I can't stop my hands from shaking. After passing King's Throne, which is a tall, slender rock that looks like a high-backed chair, I immediately spot two tall trees leaning against one another at slight angles, their branches appearing like arms wrapped around each other in an embrace, and I smile, for a brief moment, forgetting how terribly scared I am. Only one more to go, Sam says, pulling me back into the clutches of reality. We reach Lookout Point 5 minutes later. All told, the hike has taken 1 hour and 10 minutes, and the shadows are long and stretched as the last light of dusk drains away. Without warning, a deep growl bellows beside me. I look down. Bernie Kosar's teeth are flashed, his fur bristling along his spine, his eyes pointed in the direction of the cave. He begins backing away from it. It's okay, Bernie Kosar, I say, patting his back. Sam and I drop to the ground and lay on our stomachs, both staring across the small valley at the cave's almost indiscernible entrance. It's far larger than I'd imagined, probably 20 feet wide and tall, but also much better hidden. There's something covering it, a net or a tarp, maybe, making it blend in with its surroundings. You'd have to know it's there to be able to see it. Perfect location, Sam whispers. Totally. My nervousness quickly turns to full-blown terror. As mysterious as the cave is, one thing I know for sure is that there'll be no shortage of things, weapons, beasts or traps that could kill us. I could die within the next 20 minutes, and Sam could too.